For 36 years, the Goldman Environmental Prize has celebrated everyday heroes who are showing us that every action has the power to turn apathy into positive change for the environment. Heroes like Bastiana Gurri and Olsi Nika, who helped create Europe's first Wild River National Park. Visit us at goldmanprize.org to discover the stories of this year's Goldman Environmental Prize winners. And learn how when it comes to protecting our planet, the doing makes the difference.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing deals for members. Signature Select Classic Ham, shank half or whole, bone in while supplies last, just 89 cents per pound. Enjoy 1 pound strawberries or 6 ounce blueberries, raspberries, or blackberries. Buy two, get two free of equal or lesser value when you buy four. And mix and match Nabisco snack crackers, Ritz crackers, Cheetos, Doritos, Tostitos, or Sun Chips, selected varieties and sizes. Buy two, get two for free when you buy four. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
All right, back on the Jeff Gonkin Show. Let's do this Chris Herrington deal. Chris Herrington joins me now. Chris, what are you listening to?
It's Time Escaping by Big Thief. I'm sending that out to Santi Aldama, who stood with the ball as time escaped on him last night.
Let's start there then. What did you think of the 5-second call to play?
So I've seen a couple people on social media, like, you know, with the video stamp, and say it was 6.3 seconds. It was in or 6 seconds or whatever, which is still actually pretty quick for a 5-second call, honestly. But both of the videos I saw, people started the clock the second the ball touched Aldama's hands. I don't think that's the way it works. The referee hands the ball to Aldama, takes a step to the side and signals with his hand. That's only 1 second.
Right.
But if you start it at that moment, I'm not saying it was an incorrect call, but it was right at 5 seconds. Like, right. There was no grace. And to me, in that moment, just as a basketball fan, it's like I don't like ticky-tack travel calls. Like, let players decide the game, and like if it gets like 6.5, sure, blow it. But like don't be in a hurry to blow a 5-second call in that situation. People want to see the final play, you know. So like the Grizzlies didn't execute it well, but I think they got no grace from the official on that.
Okay, on the not executing it well part of that, I wonder, like, as they size up Isolo's chances in the end, like in the end, there's a 5-second call that you didn't execute, critical moment of a game. Like, is there? Santi shouldn't have, he had to let go of the ball no matter what. Like,
yeah,
he had to let go of the ball.
I mean, it's hard to pick apart the coaching stuff from the player stuff on that. And I have not Zapruder filmed it. The reality is in basketball, and we don't have a choice. We talk about what would happen, but most of us have not gone back in slow motion the game, right? And you're guessing half the time of what you think you see unless you go back and watch film in basketball. It didn't jump out to me as a particularly well-designed play call. I'm not a coach, but it didn't say, you know, I think, you know, there's probably coaching criticism to be levied there. At the same time, like, you got to get the ball in. And so I think it's both. And also, like, the officials are quick on the 5-second call. They weren't quick to call fouls when, like, guys are being held. Like, John Morant
and Jared
are being
held,
right?
Right, yes, right.
So, like,
right.
Either, like, you know, either be willing to call anything that you see that's you know, a violation, or like let it go a little bit. And so to me, I didn't really like, from both an officiating standpoint and a Grizzly standpoint, I don't think things went well on the final play. But here's the other thing about it. There were, at that point, from the second the ball is put in Santi Aldama's hands, there are multiple hurdles in front of the Grizzlies to win that game. And they did not get past the first hurdle, and that was frustrating.
Right.
But the odds were stacked up against them to get through the rest of the hurdles at that point, too. No, because even if you get it, if you inbounds it, you're probably going to not make the shot. Even if you make the shot, it's a shot to tie.
Right.
And now you're going your tie game in overtime in their building with Morant hurt and Scottie Pippen is now fouled out, who's your best defender on staff. And if you want to question Isolo, I think that's more fertile ground for questioning because that's not subject to interpretation. They knew they had to foul, and he had Pippen in the game with five fouls, risking him fouling out when you're trying to get to overtime to begin with. Lionel Hollins did this once upon a time in that triple overtime game where he put O.J. Mayo in to foul when he had five, and I was sitting courtside. I looked in O.J. Mayo's face as he looked to Lionel Hollins and waved his hand and said, I got five, and Lionel put him in anyway, and he fouled out. So that was a coaching error.
I actually think in terms of the hurdles, and Jeffrey and I talked about this earlier, if you're going to circle one moment or one play, it would be with 2:05 left, they're trailing 111-109. They have the ball in transition, and Ja turns it over.
Was that
and
the one where he tried to force the pass to Edie, and it was a bad pass?
Bad pass to Edie, and then they go back right after that, and Steph hits the three, and basically, at that point, it's your climb.
Ja did that like three times in the last 2 minutes in the game 2 weeks ago against Golden State, and I had noted that. And that was only one, but the one was bad enough. And to me, they've gotten turnovers trying to force Steph to Edie, but in those moments,
can't do it.
Right, can't do it.
He's not fruitful to throw it to him anyway.
Well, it's not like it was a good pass. It's not like he bobbled a pass right in his hands. It was a bad decision on the front end and a bad pass. And so, yeah, I agree. That was a bad play.
So what was your fundamental takeaway from the game?
It's sort of what Isolo said, his quote, the Drew sort of put in his headline of, like, you know, this has been the story. The story is this has been the story. And it's been a situation where – and I know, and to me, the evidence on Isolo is totally mixed. To me, it's not strong either way about what his future should be. But I do think if you're watching the games closely, I know the outcomes haven't changed that much. But if you look at the Grizzlies over the past 2 weeks and then compare that to the previous 2 weeks, sort of that coaching change departure, I think when you factor in the schedule and you factor in their diminishing options, to diminish options, I think they've played better. It's just they're getting, instead of losing by 15, you know, against Portland and Sacramento, they're getting in these games where it's like a jump ball game with 3 minutes to go against Golden State, against Denver. And the other teams have better best players, frankly, have more experienced best players. And you're just looking up, and you got like five or six guys you can believe in. And like, this may sound like a rationale, but I think I'm just trying to figure out what's true. It is super easy to look at that game last night and say, well, if you had Brandon Clark and Jalen Wells, you're probably winning that game.
Right.
If you had Brandon Clark and Jalen Wells at Denver, you're probably winning that game. Right. And so I think for all the problems that they have and the problems that are sort of inherent in some of the roster flaws, which we've been talking about, losing Wells and Clark were just absolutely killers for this team. Not in terms of their ability to, like, go on a run in the playoffs, because that was not going to happen. But in terms of getting to the playoffs and, like, putting up a fight, like, it just killed them not having those guys.
Yeah. Tip of the hat to you, because you – two things that we talked about in advance. And, by the way, this goes to – like, people may look at Isolo, the L's, and, you know, the five-second call. But you wondered out loud whether they would – Scott – start Scottie Pippen Jr.
That was the right decision.
And you wondered out loud whether we'd see some John Conchar.
That was the right decision, too, given their options. Those were both good decisions.
And they played out pretty well, I thought.
No, and who knows, like, Vince Williams was terrible in 3 minutes.
Oh.
If you play him six, does it get better? Maybe, maybe not. But in that situation, you put him out there for three, it's not working, you pull the plug. It's probably right coaching decisions all around. Getting Pippen out there and having him on Curry as much as possible was the right decision. And you got to play somebody. And, like, I thought the reason I had suggested Conchar might play, I thought there were some clues that he might play. But the reason I thought that was probably a thing they should do is because in this specific matchup, the thing you really need is awareness. Guys who are not just, like, getting lost in the heat of the moment. And the ball's moving and players are moving. And you got to sort of have your head in the game. And for all of Conchar's limitations and physicality and skill, his head is in the game, right? He's an active player, and so I thought he gave them good minutes,
Also, right from the jump, they had Edie. Well, you wondered You wondered if they would not have Jaren on Jimmy Butler because of the foul issues. In the end, you thought they might do Dez on him, and they did Edie.
Yeah, my guess was halfway right. And to me, this is a very debatable coaching thing. And my initial reaction was it was a coaching mistake. My thoughts are a little bit more complicated on that now that I've gone into a little bit more. But so 2 weeks ago when they started playing against Golden State, they opened the game with Jaren guarding Butler, Zach Edey guarding Draymond Green, Desmond Bane guarding Moses Moody. And my suggestion was you flop two of those three things. I would have kept Edey on Green, and then you flop Jaren on Moody, Bane on Butler to try to ease the Jaren foul trouble. So what they did was they flipped Jaren onto Green and Edey onto Butler. And part of the rationale was to mitigate the Jaren foul trouble, which worked. But now you have Zach Edey guarding Jimmy Butler, right? Jimmy Butler goes for 38. Nate Duncan, I'll give him credit, who was at the game because he lives in that area, asked Isolo about this, and he played the full answer audio on his podcast, which I'll do this morning. And there was a lot of rationales to that, and a lot of them made sense. And the reaction that Nate and his co-host Danny had was like, you know, it worked out okay. Like, you know, they lost the game, and Butler had a big night scoring-wise, but, like, he made two threes. He wasn't, like, the sagging off wasn't that. And, like, it helped in some other areas, and, like, you're in the game at the end. And so I don't know whether that was the right call. I think I still would have done it the way I suggested and kept Edey on Green, but I don't know that was some, like, coaching error that cost them the game either. Because there were other factors that Isolo talked about why they did that.
Thoughts on Zach Edey?
So I made the mistake of going on Twitter this morning. I wish people would just gravitate more to Blue Sky. You don't have to create content for Elon Musk. You do have options. But I went on Twitter, and apparently my feed is well cultivated because I saw tons of people defending Zach Edey against the charges, but I saw none of the charges. So the thing about Edey is he's the kind of player right now who – The bad parts of his game, his bad moments, they jump up and they wave their arms and say, hey, everybody, look at me, look at this bad moment.
Right.
And the good parts of his game are things people just dismiss because, oh, it's because he's big. He's got all these rebounds because he's 7'5 or 7'4. Well, that's why he's good.
Right.
You know, it reminds me back in the day, the early Grizzlies and Memphis era, rest in peace to former radio host Jeff Weinberger. He used to complain all the time about Pau Gasol and his plastic points. This guy gets plastic points. He gets all these easy open dunks.
Right.
And I used to say all the time, he's 7'1".
And he runs like
a freaking guy. And he runs the floor, and he can finish with either hand, and he's second in the NBA in dunks after Shaq, and that's why he's good, you know? And that's the thing with Edey. You know, he just gets all these rebounds because he's big. Yeah, that's why he's good. I think, like, I found myself yelling at Edey on the TV. Like, I was like, go quicker. Like, make a quicker decision.
It's incredible.
No, it's frustrating.
That he was this good at Purdue, and he is so tentative.
Yeah.
No, whether he's passing out of the double team or in.
He's super frustrating, and guess what? They were better with him on the floor.
By 6 points.
And so I am frustrated by Edey's bad moments in a game like that. I share the frustration. I get it. I see it, too. And yet, rookie center in his first ever postseason game, like on the road against Golden State, I generally feel really good about that. I'm excited about what he can be next season if he can keep getting a little bit better.
Well, and we've talked about this before. I just think the things that are frustrating me are things that are totally fixable.
A lot of the defensive stuff, not necessarily.
By the way, he didn't have any blocks, but he changes a lot of
shots.
Yes,
100%.
Changes a lot. And so, but all that offense, the weird thing is we thought he would be a force offensively, and we were wrong.
The more consistent finishing, the quicker finishing, the reading double teams better, all that stuff can get fixed. This dude is going to rattle off 2015 games next season. He really is.
I agree with that completely. So I'm not pounding him.
And if you have Brandon Clark, you have more outs to go to defensively if you think his defense is a problem, which they just don't have right now.
Okay,
by the way, speaking of that, Santi, a little bit of the GOAT because he held the ball and got the five-second call. I thought Santi played a good game, and he was bad in the previous game against Golden State. And that was someone I was looking at, like, are you there for this game? Are you there for it in this game? And I wasn't sure if he would be, and I think he was, other than that five-second call.
Vince was not there for it.
No.
Are you worried it's just going to chalk up the Vince? I mean, it is amazing. You look at it was going to be Marcus Smart, or it was going to be Gigi, or it was going to be Vince, and it's none of them. And are you just chalking all this up to, in terms of what you're counting on him being for the Grizzlies next year? Where are you?
I still believe that if we're assuming health, and he's had problems staying healthy, so that's the other thing. But if he is healthy, I still think Vince Williams is a high floor player. I don't know about the ceiling, right? Right. But in terms of a guy who can be like the eighth guy in your rotation, who's like, you know, giving you hustle plays and sprinkling in some rebounds and some passes and some steals and just giving you minutes of energy off the bench, I have full faith that he can be at least that. Can he be more than that? That I'm less sure about now.
Bane was great.
Yeah.
Ja was gutty and all of that stuff and very good, but also the five turnovers, you know.
Only three assists. And that's the thing I've noticed lately. Like, the assist numbers are down. They've gone back to more Ja-centric, but it's more Ja-centric looking to score.
Right.
And I don't think that's the best Grizzlies basketball. And so going forward, whether Isolo's the coach or someone else is, I would get away from just
the Ja-Jaren balance too, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. You know, in the same podcast, Nate's podcast I listened to, and they sort of got into this. They're talking about how, like, apparently there were a couple plays late, and I have to go back and watch where they ran like a Ja-Jaren pick and roll and got good shots out of it. And they're like, huh, why don't they do that more? Well, what happened to that, right? You know? So I think the getting the Ja-Jaren together interaction more is something that the next coach should focus on going into next season, which gets you back to Jaren. And I mentioned Blue Sky. I didn't do a lot of game posting. I did a little bit all over there last night. But one of the posts I did make was to say, Jaren has got to be more of an impact player on both ends of the floor in this game, and he wasn't.
Right.
He was not – I wouldn't say he was bad. It was a mixed bag. But he was just okay, and just okay was not good enough for him in that game.
Yeah, I agree with that fundamentally. So the turnovers, by the way, I mean, we talk about it's more of the same. Some of this is more of the same. The recent vintage we've seen coming close and against good teams and losing, right, nevertheless. But the turnovers have been a problem, obviously, all year long.
Yeah.
So what do you ascribe that? I mean, obviously, the Warriors are tremendous defensively.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, the turnover problems in the first half last night are necessarily the same as the turnover problems they had in the first half of the season.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't know. But it was a problem last night.
Ja says he's going to play. Nice. Of course, that's a good thing to say. But we'll see
how the moment. I mean, sleep on it, and the doctors look at it, and we'll see.
We'll see what it looks like.
It didn't look great. Well, even when he played, it didn't look great. And this is not a team that's on the cusp of a title and you push through. This is not Isaiah Thomas going to run around on one ankle. You know, this team is in a different spot. He's in a different spot. And so I don't know if this is one you would force.
Well, that gets us to, and I gather you have a piece that's going up here in a minute, and you led with this, and there's been a lot of talk about this. I was totally misrepresented on the Drew Hill, Chris Harrington podcast, because – and even then, I'm not sure what I think about it.
But I think Drew was – I was just answering Drew's question.
I know. Drew misrepresented. It was true. I've talked to Drew about this subsequently. He didn't understand.
Right.
My view had been that if they were to lose last night, that my preference would be taking it two bad options. One would be win Friday and then get smoked by Oklahoma City in four straight games and lose your draft pick. I don't need to see him get smoked by Oklahoma City, and I don't need him to lose their draft pick. The others, you lose Friday, you get your draft pick. You don't have to go through the indignity of losing to Oklahoma City four straight, but you do have the indignity of losing to a bad team at home and missing the playoffs. And I was like, clearly the team is going to do and should do everything it can to win, and every player will do everything. But I can vote what I want in my own heart, what I wish for them. That was my only thing. Although, and Chris, Drew was suggesting, I thought they should do something actionable, was his word. No, of course not. But it is interesting now that you have the Ja ankle.
The Morant thing gives them an actionable thing they could do.
There's an actionable thing.
If they secretly wanted to lose the game.
I don't think they
But it could also be something they should do, even if they not so secretly want to win the game. It's sitting him down, I mean.
If they,
it could be the right move regardless.
Anyway, for health purposes, yes, going on regardless.
Yeah.
I actually started to reconsider. Last night, given how hard they fought, given that culture matters, winning matters, given that I think Zach Edey profits from being in these games, I think I'm just going to be I'm being fine with whatever happens. I think I'm going to abandon my I will prefer it if they lose view. But what do you have to say about all this?
I wrote about it. I'm sure better than I'll be able to talk about it. So I'll refer to you to my written statement.
I'll see if it's
Your
up
Honor.
In the meantime. Yes.
But I to me, what I sort of led with was that moment of looking to that Friday game. And you can choose to see it in a win-win frame. You can choose to see it in a lose-lose frame in terms of the outcomes, right? If you want to feel good about it, or not good, if you want to feel better about it, you could say, you know, we win, we're back in the playoffs, we lose, we still get the pick, it's fine either way. You could turn that around and say, it's a bad beat either way.
I think it's more right. bad either way,
yeah.
honestly.
Right. But there is that duality to it.
You'll just watch it unfold and react to see what happens and hope.
Well, I mean, I have no control over it.
Right,
so
that's definitely what I will do.
Right.
That's the other thing. None of us have any control over it. The if the goal is to win, who should they want to play?
I did this exercise, which I never wrote about because the Grizzlies rendered it irrelevant to the Grizzlies. But if you look at the 10 West teams in the postseason and you look at their net rating only for players likely to be in their playoff rotation and get rid of everything else all season that is irrelevant now and just look at that, Dallas is a distant 10th. Sacramento's 9th. Grizzlies drop down to 8 sharply once you take Brandon Clark and Jalen Wells out. Still slightly ahead of the Sacramento as I did it, but Dallas is like way
down. Sacramento is the better team.
Has been the better team with the players they're bringing in the playoffs. That's even taking out Malik Monk, who is injured. But Dallas does have the best player.
Right.
And that is Anthony Davis, and that is a player the Grizzlies have struggled with before. And so I would say you'd rather play Dallas, but I think you could argue either side of that. Given the Grizzlies' defensive issues, Sacramento's a really good offense. And so, you know, I just don't know. I'd probably rather play Dallas in that situation, but you could argue it either way.
And what good could come of the Oklahoma City series?
It's hard to see that going more than 5 games. You cannot rationally talk yourself into that series going more than
18.
5 games.
They've lost by an average of 18.
I do think Edie getting some playoff reps is probably a good thing. I mean, Scottie Pippen, who's never played in the playoffs, getting some reps. I think when you know you got 4 games, it's a little bit, and you're not desperate about it. Like, you're probably going to lose anyway. So, like, you got at least whatever 4 times 48 is minutes of playoff basketball to play with. I think you open the rotation back up and you give Vince Williams some playoff minutes. And if, like, he struggles with it, like, okay, fine, right. You're losing anyway. Maybe you get G.G. Jackson some playoff minutes. Maybe, you know, you're not playing a 6-man rotation for 48 minutes through 4 games. You're just not. And so you open things up a little bit. You get some guys some playoff run. You get some more evidence to judge Tuomas Asalo's decision-making in games. I think it's a mixed bag so far. Like, one of the things we haven't talked about is the coach's challenge. I think he's been pretty bad on coach's challenges.
That was terrible. Yeah.
Not just in that game. I think they've generally been bad. Now, that's a coaching staff thing because the head coach is looking back and getting signals about whether to do this stuff. And I don't think they've been worse at that since the coaching changes. And so
it's a diminished staff now anyway.
Yeah,
it's not
even
a complete staff.
You're getting more reps for players who have not been in the playoffs, and you're getting more sample of how Isolo handles the team and handles game situations and that kind of stuff. So there's something to be gained, sure.
All right, so the good news is Chris's piece is up over at the Daily Memphian, and I have tweeted it out. So if you want to read the his more thoughtful disquisition on all of this, you can do that over at the Daily Memphian. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. We got Sam Hardiman coming up next. If you're looking for a new financial institution, Leaders Credit Union is the one I would suggest, because I suggested it to Claire, and I suggested it to Claire's son, Conroy, and they're both absolutely thrilled. The technology, the app is unbelievably easy, sophisticated. Because it's a credit union, they don't have to, you know, they don't have stockholders they have to pay off. Every dollar goes back into better technology, better rates, better service. It stands to reason that the app is fabulous, and it is. Leaders Credit Union, they've got a branch in Bartlett. They've got a brand new branch in Arlington, but you just have to download the app. LeadersCU.com/ESPN. So, Jeffrey, we have other things to talk about. Nico is going into the portal today. That's today, right?
With a do not contact tag.
But a do not. I also, by the way, just for the record, I have a do not contact tag So we have other things to get to from the world of sports, but Sam Hardiman is going to join us to talk about the city of Memphis when we return. It is the Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Green from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
All right, back at the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Sam Hardiman. Sam Hardiman writes for the Daily Memphian, where he covers the city. But before I talk to Sam about the city, I want to ask him some very important sports-related questions. One is, Sam, I have it on good authority, someone very close to you, that you have bought a Pats sweatshirt and cut off the sleeves. Is this true?
That source did not have quite all the story. The sweatshirt was bought in 2012. I want to be clear about this.
Okay.
So it is a legacy sweatshirt that I've had for some time.
Okay.
Over many, many washes, it's gotten a little too small, and maybe I've just gotten a little,
Maybe you're getting
fatter.
Buff. Maybe you're getting buff.
Maybe just chunky. I have cut off the sleeves. The other night, I said to my wife, I think I'm going to cut off the sleeves. And, she kind of said, oh, you won't do it. I did it.
Do you wear it out and about? Do you feel like Bill Belichick wearing it out and about?
I have worn it in the apartment. It will see the street at some point. Like, I'm not afraid of it. I show my pasty little arms with this cut off sleeves sweatshirt, but... It hasn't yet, and given the weather, it may not for some time.
Speaking of Bill Belichick, by the way, he's been in the news recently because he has a girlfriend. Jeffrey, how old is the girlfriend? The girlfriend is?
I believe 25.
26.
Okay, 26.
And how Jordan old, Huntsman is 26.
And how old is Bill Belichick?
74, 70. Right?
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Okay, let me ask you this. This is eye rolling. It's not predatory, right? But it's eye rolling. She's a grown up, but it is eye rolling. Can we agree on that?
Yes.
Okay. What is not eye like? What if he was dating a 42-year-old?
I mean, that's pretty close to what he was engaged to. He was engaged to like a 50-something girl before they broke up.
You wouldn't even begin to roll your eyes at it. Let me ask you this: I'm 9 years older than Claire. You rolling your eyes because I got a young hottie?
No. The problem is. I believe all of Bill's kids are older than
you think
she is.
That's the cutoff? The kids? Like,
that's pretty weird.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I mean, it's more than a little weird. Like, to be honest, like the group chats have been very, very many New England sports dominant group chats, right?
Yeah.
Like, that is the dominant discourse. And like, Bill has jumped the shark for, like, all of us. Essentially, like, whole situation,
Do you worry about him, or you're disgusted?
Bill has never inspired sympathy, right? Like, he's not a sympathetic figure. So, like, it's not like, our buddy's, like, kind of gone off the rails. It's more of, like, the guy we used to really be afraid of. He appears to be, like, kind of in weird, like, weird straits. Like, that's kind of how it is. Like, this guy we respected, we're like, oh, boy. I don't know about that. That's how I feel.
Well, I mean, the worst one recently was the video of, what's her name, Jordan?
Jordan Hudson.
At the UNC spring practice, walking onto the field to talk to Bill with her high heels. This is the most fearsome coach there is, you know? On to Sunday.
We're on to Cincinnati, Jeff.
On to Cincinnati. It's crazy. I mean, have you seen that video, Sam?
I saw the video. I watched it multiple times. Like I really engaged with that video. Like the X algorithm, like, fed me more content based on my engagement of that video. And it was weird, man. And it's just like the Athletic article where essentially she's like telling the communications staff of the University of North Carolina, like, first of all, Public Records Act people, okay, like, know that these emails are public record, and people are going to be looking for them, okay, like 101, first of all, like, as a journalist, free tip. But also, like, saying, like, we don't want Steve to feel like he's an appendage or of
this is Steve Belichick's son, who's the defensive coordinator. Yeah. She wanted him to not mention that he's the son and to be held up as his own man.
Yeah. I mean that shows an interesting dynamic, I think, between father and son. I think that's what that revealed. But it's weird.
Okay. Then a separate sports question is, we're faced with this dilemma, Grizzlies fans, and maybe many don't have this dilemma. Maybe people are just all in for the Grizzlies to win.
It was in my group chat with my high school friends, so it's not just you.
We'll probably take calls on this tomorrow, whether you want the Grizzlies to win Friday or not. You have before, as a sports fan, it's not some violation of sports fandom to, in different circumstances, want your team to lose, is it? Take your Bruins this year.
Oh, I mean, I've been actively rooting for them to lose. Like I've been upset when they won. But anyway, go ahead, the question.
But that's the question. It's not that. That is the fundamental question. It's fine. You are not a bad sports fan if you're, and particularly, it's a little different because this is a play-in situation. But a draft pick is at stake for the Grizzlies. And why are you rooting for your Bruins to lose?
I mean, because the Bruins desperately need a first-round draft pick because they haven't taken one in like 4 or 5 years. It's a little different. But in terms of like the Grizzlies fans, like I can understand the point, the rationale for people saying, well, rather than get smoked by the Thunder in 5 games, right, why not just fall into the lottery and see what happens?
People felt totally different when it was playing the Rockets. The people who are on this side, no one was like, lose last night and then whatever. It's just because who the hell needs to see them get destroyed? They've lost those Thunder games by an average of 18 points. And sadly, it's not one and done. You've got to take 4 beatings before the season ends. I can see avoiding that. Anyway, all right, onward we go. XAI is the topic. You had a story about, because one of the benefits of having XAI here is the tax revenue, and yet the tax revenue may not be what one might have hoped. Explain to me the XAI tax story.
Yeah, so yeah, first you can find this story on the Daily Memphian website. Please go subscribe, support our work, donate, etc. Shill for the website done. Now, what happened is XAI has invested probably well north of $10 billion in Memphis, Tennessee, okay, in terms of actual equipment in Memphis, Tennessee. If the company is to be believed, and there is no reason to not believe the company in terms of what they've invested in Memphis, Tennessee. However, they are only being taxed on about $2 billion in investment. And I have been after this tax bill for weeks. I mean, it was due essentially back to the assessor's office on March 3rd, and the assessor's office has been getting a call from me every other day since then. So, you know, they're really sick of me over there. But what essentially happened is the assessor's office worked with XAI to shield the company in a way to shield or shelter the amount of actual investment that was going to be taxed. And essentially what they're being taxed on is they're being taxed on as if many of the chips, the very valuable microchips that are semiconductors that power Grok, that power the large language model that XAI runs and is their real business, those are being taxed at a lower rate than they would because they're not being, quote, assessed as new. And what the assessor's office explained this to me is essentially said that we trust what they've given us, but we only tax on what is new and what was on the property as of January 1, 2025. And the deputy assessor, Jay Bailey, said to me, essentially, he said the company, you can read the direct quote in our story, that if equipment is sent to another facility, so these servers and these chips are sent to another facility before they come to Memphis, they will be assessed as old versus new. And these the chips, they depreciate really, really fast. So that value is actually quite different between an old chip and a new chip.
Are they being sent to a new place literally just to get around this? Or are these, in fact, older chips? Like, is this totally, hey, if we send them to Sacramento for a minute or whatever, then they'll be here and we can avoid. Is it totally a loophole they're taking advantage of? Or are they, in fact, older chips because they've been deployed somewhere.
I believe what I would say is I don't know if they're actually being sent somewhere, first of all. Second, I would say that these are NVIDIA H100s and H200s. So they are, quote, older models, but really state-of-the-art artificial intelligence chips. Okay, so not old in the sense of, like, my old 2006 Civic was old, okay? So I want to make that clear, and I also want to be clear, and I want to be fair to the company here. XAI, in terms of assessed value, what is actually being taxed in Memphis, Tennessee, okay?
Yeah.
Is now the second highest assessed company in Memphis, Tennessee. Jeffrey, a trivia question for you if you didn't read the article, but if you did, it's okay. But Jeffrey, what is the number one assessed company in Memphis, Tennessee?
FedEx?
Yeah, duh. Exactly. So, like, XAI has come, and in the span of a year, become the second highest taxpayer in Memphis, Tennessee. All right? So, while the story provoked outrage, and I certainly understand that, right, they are also the second highest taxpayer in the city and are going to be giving the city of Memphis likely $16 million in tax revenue this year, which is about 1.8% of the total city budget, which is big money.
All right. Well, speaking of outrage, we have a separate story that you did since we last spoke, with the environmental groups urging the Shelby County Health Department to issue an emergency order to stop the operation of the natural gas turbines in Southwest Memphis. What's the latest on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the latest is the Southern Environmental Law Center, like we have at the Daily Memphian. You know, we use the drone. I believe they use the helicopter. Flew over the XAI facility in Southwest Memphis and took a look. And what they saw was far more natural gas turbines than had previously been noticed before. And they are arguing that those 35 turbines amount to what would be the largest polluter in Memphis, Tennessee. It would be greater than the Valero refinery. It would be greater than the TVA gas plant. I want to be clear. While they are alleging that the company is violating the Clean Air Act, which is the federal law that essentially governs our air and the quality of it that we breathe. I want to be clear that we don't actually know if all 35 of those turbines are running or if the company is using some of those turbines as sort of a strategic reserve of, let's say it gets really hot this summer, right? And they need to come off the Tennessee Valley Authority Memphis Light, Gas, and Water grid, but they need to keep Grok running because they're a private business. They can ramp those turbines up, use the Tesla megapacks that are ubiquitous around the site and do that. But what it does and what has prompted is it has really prompted more concern from environmental groups who see XAI and see Elon Musk, and Elon Musk's sort of notoriety at the federal level continues to rear itself here as just a polluter who is just coming into Memphis and doing what he wants. And that's the outrage about it.
Yeah. All right, Sam, totally unrelated. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you about this. So, but I was at the, Huey's had a 55th birthday party Sunday, and so I stopped by, listened, watched Lucero. It was a great scene, whatever else. I just tweeted, took a photo of the shell on wheels where the little replica of they call it the Levitt shell anymore. What do we call it anymore? What do they call the shell?
I don't know. It's the Orion shell. Yeah, I don't know. The Overton Park shell.
They've got this little miniature shell on wheels. It's totally cool. I put a beautiful picture. And then immediately the first tweet comes back is, yeah, and someone was shot down at Riverside Drive today. It is just so, and you live downtown, it must be so frustrating for the mayor because you can make macro progress, which no one then believes when something like this happens, right? In fact, it's been a bad week. It's not just been that. It was the shooting at the anti-violence prevention group and whatever else. I don't know, thoughts on what happened Sunday. I know you didn't report on this. The Daily Memphian did report on that incident. But thoughts on that and generally how you feel, by the way, about things as a downtown resident these days.
Yeah. So first of all, because I'm a downtown resident, I was actually in Tom Lee Park probably about 45 minutes after the shooting allegedly occurred.
Yeah.
And I say allegedly because the police have essentially said they responded to a scene about 6:45 on Sunday night. We don't know when the person who was killed died and when they were shot. And the reason I highlight this is because I was in the park And I was observing the food truck festival. My wife and I were trying to take a nice walk. It was a gorgeous sunset over the Mississippi River. And no one was panicking. Like, typically when there are shootings,
right,
people panic. People run, okay? And the entire food truck festival, you wouldn't have known anything happened. There was a heavy police presence. There were a lot of empty cruisers that were running. It was odd to me that there were so many empty cruisers that were running. And then as we were essentially getting into our apartment, the first TV push alert hit that there had been a shooting in Tomley Park. And so as a downtown resident, like, I don't feel unsafe on a daily basis. First of all, I feel, you know, it's one of the safest places in the city. And I feel fine. At the same time, the point that you made about the mayor and the frustration, I think that's real. I think what it is it's a perception thing, right? You can go 363 days a year in downtown Memphis, and it can be one of the safest places in the community. And there are other incidents that happen in downtown Memphis. I want to make that clear. This isn't just one thing. There are other things that do happen there. You know, people were doing donuts that very night at Peabody Place in Main Street. Like, I watched that happen. Okay. Like, a couple minutes after the shooting allegedly occurred. But like, that all can happen and be relatively rare, but because it's on the news, because it's broadcast in the media so much, it shapes the perception of people who don't live downtown. And often, I'm not saying are looking for reasons not to go.
No, some people totally glory in spreading that stuff, 100%.
Right, right. But then there's the people, like, if you're going to make your, you know, marginal purchase of, like, do I go to this Grizzlies game or do I go out to dinner in a place I perceive as safer than downtown Memphis, right? And you're making that choice. Something like this can totally tip the balance. And so when you get sort of that feedback loop of, oh, downtown's dangerous, someone got shot there, that is very bad for Memphis and is very bad for downtown, because there's a tremendous amount of public dollars that have been invested in downtown and into propping up downtown. And so things like this are very, you know, beyond how the mayor feels about them, they're very bad in sort of ways for the city's finances. Yep.
Sam, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
Sam Hardiman, read his stuff over at the Daily Memphian. This would be a great day to get to Oak Hall. I was there just very recently. You walk in and spring has sprung at Oak Hall. You walk in and you see the Peter Millar, you see the Johnny O, Alan Payne, you see the cotton is big again, beautiful cotton polos. You got the knit shirts out, you got the performance. It's just absolutely a stunning legendary store. And when you say stunning and legendary store, I'll be honest, there was a time back when George used to do these spots that I'm like, God, am I going to be intimidated if I go into Oak Hall? Like, I dress like kind of a schlep. And the truth of the matter is, it is so warm. It is so welcoming. They have treated me so well. And they do that for everyone who walks in their doors. The clothes are beautiful. The people are even better. People are, in fact, the secret sauce. So if you're sprucing up for spring, wherever you're headed, whether it's to the beach or to your backyard barbecue, go on in and spruce yourself up. Hey, get ready for Easter, man, with a trip to Oak Hall. Jeffrey, do we have time to take a break, or shall I just ask you what is coming up next? How do you want to handle this? You know what it is? This is an end-of-game situation. It's not unlike the Grizzlies, and I'm a little bit like Santi Aldama here. Whoops, running out of time. Running out of time. Jeffrey, what's coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason and John. Drew Hill and Coach Hurd are going to join them today. Kevin Cerrito will be with me on Jeffrey Wright and Company. CJ Hurt's going to join us in the second hour. It is Wednesday, so that means Cobb will be the Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back tomorrow for Now Work Is Done.